They beat her. They beat her hard, cruelly, as a man is beaten, with blows that aren't just meant to hurt, but meant to fracture, meant to crush all energy and the will to resist from the victim. She was beaten, jerking in the steely grip of many hands. She wanted to faint, but couldn't. She could feel it. "Enough," she suddenly heard from far away, from behind the curtain of pain. "Have you gone mad, Ryans? Do you mean to kill her? I need her alive." "I vowed her, master," snarled the shadow looming in front of her, which gradually took on Ryans's form and face. "I promised I'd pay her back. With these hands."
"I care little for what you promised her. I repeat, I need her alive and capable of articulated speech."
"It's not so easy," laughed the one holding her by the hair, "to knock the life out of a cat or a witch."
"Don't be clever, Skiru. I said she's been sufficiently beaten. Pick her up. How do you do, Yennefer?"
The sorceress spat red and lifted her puffy face. At first, she didn't recognize him. He was wearing a kind of mask, covering the entire left side of his head. But she knew who it was.
"Go to hell, Filkefortz," she mumbled,
gingerly touching her front teeth and cut lips with her tongue.
"What did you make of my spell? Did you like it when I lifted you in that boat up from the sea? Did you enjoy the flight? What charms did you protect yourself with to survive the fall?"
"Go to hell.
Tear that star from her neck and to the laboratory with her. Let's not waste time."
She was dragged, pulled, occasionally carried. A stony plane, with Alcyone lying smashed on it, amid numerous other wrecks with protruding ribs, like the skeletons of sea monsters. Krach was right, she thought. The ships that disappeared without trace on the Sedna Abyss weren't victims of natural disasters. Ye gods! Pavetta and Duni. Above the plain, in the distance, mountain peaks thrust up into the overcast sky. Then there were walls, gates, cloisters, floors, staircases. Everything somehow odd, unnaturally large. Still too few details to let her work out where she was, where she'd come to, where the spell had carried her. Her face was swelling up, making observations all the more difficult. Smell became the one sense supplying her with information. She smelled formalin, ether and spirits, and magic. The smells of a laboratory. She was brutally shoved down into a steel armchair. Cold, painfully tight clamps slammed shut on her wrists and ankles. Before the steel jaws of a vice tightened on her temples and immobilized her head, she managed to glance around the large and glaringly lit room. She saw one more armchair and a strange steel construction on the stone floor.
"Yes, indeed,"
she heard the voice of Vilgefortz from behind her.
"That little chair is for your Ciri. It's been here for ages. It can't wait. Neither can I."
She heard him up close, literally felt his breath. He stuck some needles into her head, attached something to her ears. Then he stood before her and removed the mask. Yennefer sucked in air involuntarily.
"That's the work of your Ciri," he said,
indicating his once classically beautiful, now hideously mutilated face, crisscrossed with golden clasps and fastenings, securing a multifaceted crystal in his left eye socket.
"I tried to catch her when she entered the Tower of the Gull," the sorcerer calmly explained. "I meant to save her life, certain that the teleporter would kill her. How naive of me. She passed through smoothly, with such force that the portal exploded, blew up right in my face. I lost an eye and my left cheek, as well as a lot of skin from my face, neck and chest. A very disagreeable, very bothersome, very complicated accident. And very ugly, isn't it? Ha! You ought to have seen me before I began to regenerate magically. If I believed in such things," he continued, pushing a bent copper tube into her nose, "I'd have thought it was Lydia van Bredevoort's revenge from beyond the grave. I'm regenerating, but it's slow, time-consuming and heavy-going. It's particularly difficult with regeneration of the eyeball. The crystal in my eye socket plays its role splendidly. I can see in three dimensions, but yet it's a foreign body, and the lack of a natural eyeball occasionally makes me absolutely furious. Then, seized by, let's face it, irrational anger, I vow to myself that when I catch Ciri, immediately after catching her, I'll order Ryans to pluck out one of those huge green eyes with his fingers, with these fingers, as he likes to say. You're saying nothing, Yennefer. Perhaps because you know I'd also like to rip out one of your eyes? Or both?
He stuck thick needles into the veins on the back of her hands. Sometimes he missed and jabbed to the very bone. Yennefer gritted her teeth.
You've caused me problems. You've made me interrupt my work. You've exposed me to risk. Forcing your way over the Sedna abyss in that boat towards my maelstrom. The echo of our brief duel was powerful and travelled far. It may have reached the wrong ears, prying ears. But I couldn't stop myself. The thought that I would have you here, that I'd be able to connect you up to my scanner, was too appealing. For you can't possibly imagine.
He stuck in another needle. That I was taken in by your provocation?
That I swallowed the bait? No, Yennefer. If you think so, you're mistaking stars reflected in the surface of a pond at night for the sky. You thought you were tracking me, whereas in fact, I was tracking you. You made my job easier by sailing over the abyss, for I cannot find Ciri, you see, even with the help of my peerless scanning device. The girl has powerful innate defense mechanisms, her own powerful anti-magical and suppressive aura. It's the Elder blood, after all. But my super scanners ought to detect her anyhow. Yet they don't.
Yennefer was now completely entwined in a network of silver and copper wires and encased in a scaffolding of silver and porcelain tubes. Glass vessels containing colourless liquids wobbled on racks placed by the chair.
And so I thought.
Vilgefortz thrust another tube into her nose, this time a glass one.
That the only way of tracking Ciri was an empathic probe. For that, I needed someone who had a sufficiently strong emotional bond with the girl and had developed an empathic matrix, a kind of algorithm, to coin a phrase, of feelings and mutual affection. I thought about the Witcher, but he had disappeared. And besides, witches are poor mediums. I planned to order the kidnapping of Triss Merigold, our 14th from the hill. I pondered over abducting Neneca of Elendur. But when it turned out that you, Yennefer of Vengerberg, were literally forcing yourself into my hands. Truly, I couldn't have hoped for anything better. Once connected to the scanner, you will track down Ciri for me. Admittedly, the operation requires your cooperation. But there are, as you know, ways of making people cooperate. Of course, he went on, rubbing his hands. You deserve a few explanations. For example, how did I find out about the Elder Blood? About Lara Doran's legacy? What that gene actually is? How Ciri ended up having it? Who passed it on to her? How will I take it from her? And what will I use it for? How does the Sedna Maelstrom work? Who have I sucked into it? What did I do with them and why? Plenty of questions, aren't there? It's such a pity there's no time to tell you everything, explain everything. Nay, even astonish you. For I'm certain several of the facts would astonish you, Yennefer. But, as has been said before, there's no time. The elixirs are beginning to take effect. So it's time you started concentrating.
The sorceress clenched her teeth, stifling the deep groan shooting from her guts.
"I know," Vilgefortz nodded,
drawing closer a professional-looking megascope, a screen and a great crystal ball on a tripod, wrapped around by a web of silver wires.
"I know it's most disagreeable and very painful. The sooner you set about scanning, the sooner it'll be over. Well, Yennefer, I want to see Ciri here on this screen. Where she is, who she's with, what she's doing, what she eats, where and with whom she sleeps."
Yennefer screamed shrilly and wildly, in despair.
"It hurts," Vilgefortz guessed,
staring at her with his living eye and his dead crystal.
"Well, of course it hurts. Start scanning, Yennefer. Don't resist. Don't play the hero. You know full well it's impossible to endure this. The result of resistance may be pitiful. A stroke will follow. You'll suffer paraplegia or simply turn into a vegetable. Start scanning."
She clenched her jaw so hard her teeth creaked.
"Why not, Yennefer?"
the mage said kindly.
"If only out of curiosity. You're surely curious about how your darling's coping. Perhaps danger is hanging over her. Perhaps she's in need. You know, after all, how many people wish Ciri ill and desire her death. Start scanning. When I find out where the girl is, I'll bring her here. She'll be safe. No one will find her here. Ever."
His voice was warm and velvety.
"Start scanning, Yennefer. Start scanning. I implore you. I give you my word. I'll only take what I need from Ciri, and then I'll give both of you your freedom. I swear."
Yennefer gritted her teeth even harder. Blood trickled down her chin. Vilgefortz suddenly stood up and beckoned.
"Ryance?"
Yennefer felt some kind of device tightening over her hands and fingers.
"At times," said Vilgefortz, bending over her, "where magic elixirs and narcotics fail, what works on the stubborn is good old-fashioned pain. Don't make me do it. Start scanning."
"Go to hell, Vilgefortz!"
"Tighten the screws, Ryance, slowly."
Vilgefortz glanced at the torpid body being dragged across the floor towards the stairs to the cellar. Then he lifted his eye towards Ryance and Skiru.
"There's always the risk," he said, "that one of you will fall into the hands of my enemies and be interrogated. I'd like to think that you'll demonstrate as much fortitude." "Yes, I'd like to think so, but I don't."
Ryance and Skiru said nothing. Vilgefortz started up the megascope again and projected the image generated by the huge crystal onto the screen.
"That's all she could produce," he said, pointing. "I wanted Cirilla. She gave me the Witcher. Fascinating. She didn't allow the girl's empathic matrix to be wrested from her, but she cracked when it came to Geralt. And I didn't suspect her of harboring any feelings for Geralt at all. Well, for now, let's settle for what we have. Witcher, Cair Ep Kialach, the bard Dandelion, some woman? Who'll undertake this task? The final solution to the Witcher problem." "Skiru volunteered," recalled Ryance,
raising himself up in the stirrups to give his saddle-sore buttocks at least some relief.
"Skiru volunteered to kill the Witcher. He recognized the countryside Yennefer traced Geralt and his company to. He had friends or family there. Vilgefortz sent me, meanwhile, to negotiate with Vatier de Rido, and then to Tails, Skellen, and Bonnard. And I, stupidly, and was glad at the time, certain that the easier and more pleasant task had fallen to me, one I would make short, easy, pleasant work of.
If the peasants weren't lying, Stefan Skelen stood up in his stirrups. The lake must be over that hill in the valley.
The trail leads there, Boreas Munn confirmed.
Why have we stopped here?
Ryan's rubbed a frozen ear.
Spur on the horses and let's go.
Not so fast,
Bonnard held him back.
Let's split up. We'll encircle the valley. We don't know which of the lake's shores she took. If we choose the wrong way, we may put the lake between us.
Yeah, very true, Boreas nodded.
The lake's frozen over.
It may be too thin for the horses. Bonnard's right. We must split up.
Skelen quickly issued orders. The group, led by Bonnard, Ryans, and Ola Harsheim, numbering 7 horses in total, galloped along the eastern shore, quickly disappearing into the black forest.
Very well, Tawny Owl ordered. Let's go, Siliphant.
He realized at once that something wasn't right. He reined his horse around, slapped it with his knout, and rode directly for Joanna Selborne. Kenna backed up her mount, and her face seemed to be made of stone.
It's no use, sir, she said hoarsely. Don't even try. We're not going with you. We're turning back. We've had enough.
We? Dacus Elephant yelled. Who's we? What is this, a mutiny?
Skelen leaned over in the saddle and spat on the frozen earth. Andres Vieni and Tille Krada, the fair-haired elf, had stopped behind Kenna.
Miss Selborne, said Tawny Owl scathingly, in a slow, drawling voice.
It isn't the point that you are squandering a very promising career, that you're permanently throwing away the chance of a lifetime. You'll be handed over to the hangman, along with these fools who've listened to you.
Whoever's meant to hang won't drown,
Kenna replied philosophically.
And don't threaten us with a hangman, sir, for who knows who's closer to the scaffold, you or us.
Is that what you think?
Tawny Owl's eyes flashed.
You're convinced of that after slyly eavesdropping on somebody's thoughts. I thought you were cleverer than that, but you're stupid, woman. Whoever's with me wins. Whoever's against me always loses. Remember that, girl. Even though you think I'm incriminated now, I'll still manage to send you to hang. Do you hear, you mutineers? I'll have your flesh torn from your bones with red hooks.
We have but one life, sir, Tille Krada said softly. You've chosen your way, and we've chosen ours. Both are uncertain and risky. And no one knows what fate will befall any of us.
You won't set us on the girl like dogs, Mr. Skelen, sir.
Kenna raised her head proudly.
And we won't let ourselves be killed like dogs, like Naratin Tseker. Oh, enough talking. We're turning back. Boreas, come with us.
No.
The tracker shook his head, wiping his forehead with his fur hat.
Farewell. I don't wish you ill, but I'm staying. It's my service. I took the oath.
To whom?
Kenna frowned.
The Emperor or Tawny Owl? Or a sorcerer talking from a box?
I'm a soldier. I serve.
Wait,
called Dufizi Creel, riding out from behind Dacus Siliphant.
I'm with you. I've had enough of this too. Last night I dreamed of my own death. I don't want to croak for this lousy, suspicious affair.
Traitors, yelled Dacus,
flushing like a cherry. It seemed as though dark blood would spurt from his face.
Turncoats, miserable curs, shut your trap.
Tawny Owl was still looking at Kenna, and his eyes were just as hideous as the bird from which he took his name.
They've chosen their way, you heard. There's no point shouting or wasting spit.
But we'll meet again one day, I promise you.
Perhaps even on the same scaffold,
Kenna said without spitefulness. For they won't put you to death alongside noble princes, will they, Skelen?
But with us churls. But you're right. There's no point wasting spit. Let's be going. Farewell, Boreas. Farewell, Mr. Siliphant.
Dacre spat over his horse's ears.
And beyond what I said here,
Joanna Selborne proudly raised her head, brushing a dark lock from her forehead.
I have nothing to add, illustrious tribunal.
The convener of the tribunal looked down on her. His face was inscrutable, his eyes grey. And decent.
Anyway, what do I care? Thought Kenna. I'll try. You can only die once, sink or swim. I'm not going to rot in the Citadel and wait for death. Torniel didn't make wild promises. He's liable to take revenge even from beyond the grave. What do I care? Perhaps they won't notice. Sink or swim. She pressed her hand to her nose, seemingly wiping it. She looked straight into the grey eyes of the tribunal convener.
"God," said the convener, "please take the witness, Joanna Selborne, back to—"
He broke off and started coughing. Sweat suddenly broke out on his forehead.
"To the tribunal chancellery," he finished, sniffing loudly. "Write out the appropriate documents and release her. The witness Selborne is of no further use to the court."
Kenner surreptitiously wiped away the drop of blood that was trickling from her nose. She smiled charmingly and thanked him with a delicate bow.
"They've deserted," Bonnot repeated in disbelief. "More of them have deserted and just rode away like that. Skellen, you permitted it?"
"If they inform on us," Ryance began, but Torniel interrupted him at once.
"They won't inform, because they don't want to lose their own heads. And besides, what could I have done? When Creel joined them, only Bert and Munn were left with me, and there were four of them." "Four," said Bonnard malevolently, "isn't many at all. As soon as we've caught up with the girl, I'll go after them, and I'll feed them to the crows in the name of—"
"Let's catch her up first."
Tawny Owl cut him off, urging on his grey with his knout.
"Boreas, keep your eyes on the trail."
The valley was filling up with a dense blanket of fog, but they knew that down below was a lake, because there was a lake in every valley in Miltrachta. The one, meanwhile, to which the black mare's hoofprints were leading, was undoubtedly the one they were looking for, the one Vilgefortz had ordered them to look for, which he'd described to them precisely, and whose name he had given them. Tarn Mira. The lake was narrow, no wider than an arrow shot, crowded into a slightly bent crescent between high, steep hillsides covered in black spruce, beautifully sprinkled with a white, snowy powder. The hillsides were swathed in such a silence that there was a ringing in their ears. Even the crows, whose portentous cawing had accompanied them on the trail for the last fortnight or so, had fallen silent.
"This is the southern end," stated Bonnard. "If the mage hasn't made a hash of everything and landed us in it, the magical tower is on the northern shore. Keep your eyes on the trail, Boreas. If we pick up the wrong one, the lake will separate us from her."
"The trail is clear," Boreas Munn called from below. "And fresh. It's leading towards the lake."
"Ride."
Skellen brought his grey skittering on the steep slope under control.
"Downhill."
They rode down the slope, cautiously, reining back the snorting horses. They struggled through the bare, black, ice-covered thicket blocking the way to the bank. Barnard's horse stepped gingerly onto the ice, crunching through the dry reeds sticking up from the glazed surface. The ice creaked, and long arrows of cracks diverged like a star from under the horse's hooves.
"About face!"
Barnard pulled in the reins and turned his snorting horse back towards the bank.
"Dismount. The ice is thin."
"Only by the bank in the reeds,"
Dacre Siliphant judged, striking a heel onto the icy crust.
"But even here it's at least an inch and a half. It'll hold a horse sure as anything. No need to
His words were drowned out by cursing and neighing. Skellen's grey slipped, sat down on its haunches, and its legs spread apart under it. Skellen struck it with his spurs, swore again, and this time the curse was accompanied by the harsh crunch of ice breaking. The grey pounded with its forehooves. Its hind ones, imprisoned, thrashed about in the tangle, breaking up the ice and churning the dark water spurting from under it. Tawny Owl dismounted, tugged on the reins, but slipped and went sprawling, miraculously not falling under the hooves of his own horse. The two Gemarians, now also on their feet, helped him up. Ola Harsheim and Bert Brigden hauled the whinnying grey out onto the bank.
"Dismount,"
Bonnard repeated, his eyes fixed on the fog covering the lake.
"There's no sense risking it. We'll catch up with the maid on foot. She also dismounted. She's also moving on foot."
"How very true," confirmed Boreas Munn, pointing at the lake. "It's plain to see."
Only at the very edge, beneath overhanging branches, was the crust of ice smooth and translucent, like the dark glass of a bottle. Under it, reeds and water plants, turned brown, were visible.
Further from the bank, the ice was covered in a very thin layer of wet snow, and on it, as far as the fog permitted them to see, were dark footprints.
"We have her,"
Ryans cried heatedly, throwing his reins on a broken bough.
"So she's not as cunning as she seems. She set off on the ice, straight across the middle of the lake. Had she chosen one of the banks or the forest, it wouldn't have been easy to pursue her."
"Straight across the middle of the lake,"
Bonnard repeated, giving the impression of being lost in thought.
"The shortest and straightest way to the alleged magical tower Vilgefortz talked about leads across the middle of the lake. She knows that. Mann? How far ahead of us is she?"
Boreas Mann, who was already on the lake, knelt down over a bootprint, leaned over low and examined it.
"A half hour," he estimated. "Not more. It's getting warmer, but the print isn't fuzzy. You can see every hobnail in the sole."
"The lake," mumbled Bonnard, vainly trying to look through the fog,
"stretches north for more than 5 miles, so said Vilgefortz. If the maid has half an hour's start, she's about a mile ahead of us. No slippery ice?"
Mann shook his head.
"Not even that. 6-7 furlongs at most." "Even better. March."
"March," Tawny Owl repeated. "Onto the ice and quick march." They walked swiftly, puffing. The quarry's closeness excited them, filled them with euphoria like a narcotic.
"She won't escape us."
"As long as we don't lose the trail.
And as long as she isn't leading us up the garden path in this fog. It's white as milk. You can't see 20 paces ahead, damn it." "Move your asses," Ryan snarled. "Quick, quick. As long as there's snow on the ice, we're following her trail."
"The trail is fresh,"
Boreas Mann suddenly muttered, stopping and stooping down.
"Very fresh. You can see the print of every hobnail. She's just in front of us. Just in front of us. Why can't we see her? And why can't we hear her?"
Ola Harsheim wondered.
"Our footsteps boom on the ice. The snow creaks. So why don't we hear her?"
"Because you're yakking."
Ryans cut them off abruptly.
"Keep marching."
Boreas Mann took off his hat to wipe his sweat-covered forehead.
"She's there, in the fog," he said softly. "Somewhere there in the fog. But the devil knows where. The devil knows whence she'll strike. Not back there, in Dundara, on Sawin Eve."
He began to draw his sword from its scabbard with a trembling hand. Tawny Owl leapt at him, seized him by the arm, and tugged him forcefully.
"Shut your trap, you old fool," he hissed.
But it was too late. The terror had spread to the others. They also drew their swords, involuntarily positioning themselves to have one of their companions behind them.
"She's not a spectre,"
Ryan snapped loudly.
"She isn't even a witch, and there are 10 of us. In Dundara, there were only 4, and they were all drunk."
"Spread out," said Bonnard suddenly, "to the left and right in a line, and move forward together. Don't lose sight of each other."
"You too,"
Ryan's grimaced.
"Has it infected you too, Bonnard? I thought you were less superstitious than that."
The bounty hunter looked at him with eyes that were colder than ice.
"Spread out into a line," he repeated, ignoring the sorcerer. "Keep your distance. I'm going back for my horse."
"What?"
Bonnard didn't grace Ryans with an answer again. Ryans swore, but Tawny Owl quickly placed a hand on his shoulder.
"Leave it," he snapped. "Let him go, and let's not waste time. In a line. Bert and Stigwood left. Ola, right."
"What for, Skellen?"
"The ice will break more easily under men walking in a group,"
Boreas Mann muttered.
"Then spread out in a line. Furthermore, if we walk in a line abreast, there's less of a risk the wench will outflank us."
"Outflank us?" Ryan snorted. "How could she? The tracks in front of us are plain as a pikestaff. The maid is going straight ahead. Were she to try to turn, the trail would betray it."
"Enough chatter."
Tawny Owl cut them off, looking back into the fog into which Bonnard had vanished as he left them.
"Forward."
They went on.
"It's getting warmer," Boreas Mann panted. "The ice on top is melting. It'll form overflow ice. The fog's getting thicker."
"But the footprints can still be seen," said Dacus Elephant. "Moreover, it seems the girl has slowed down. Her strength is waning."
"As is ours,"
Ryalts tore off his hat and fanned himself with it.
Quiet!
Silvan suddenly stopped.
Did you hear that? What was it?
I didn't hear anything,
but I did. Like a scraping. A scraping on the ice. But not from there.
Boreas Munn pointed at the fog into which the trail was fading.
He seems to be over on the left, to the side.
I heard it too,
Tawny Owl confirmed, looking anxiously around.
But now it's gone quiet.
Damn it, I don't like it. I don't like it.
The footprints, Ryalt said with wearied emphasis. We can still see her footprints. Don't you have eyes? She's walking straight ahead. If she took even a single step to one side, we'd know it from the trail. Quick march! We'll have her soon! I give my word we'll see her in a moment.
He broke off. Boreas Munn sighed so hard his lungs groaned. Tawny Owl cursed. 10 paces in front of them, just before the limit of visibility bordered by the dense fog, the tracks ended. They vanished.
A pox on it! What is it?
Has she taken flight or what?
No, Boreas Munn shook his head. She hasn't. It's worse.
Ryalts swore crudely, pointing at scratches in the icy crust.
Skates, he growled, involuntarily clenching his fists. She has skates. Now she is darting across the ice like the wind. We won't catch her. What? Damn, his eyes has become a bonnet. We won't catch the maid without horses.
Boreas Munn hawked loudly and sighed. Skellen slowly unbuttoned his sheepskin coat, uncovering a bandolier with a row of Orions slung across his chest.
We won't have to hunt her, he said coldly. She'll be the one hunting us. I'm afraid we won't have long to wait.
Have you gone mad?
Bonnard anticipated this. That's why he went back for his horse. He knew the girl would lure us into a trap.
Beware! Listen for the grating of skates on ice.
Dacre Siliphant paled visibly, despite his cheeks being flushed from the cold.
Fellows, he yelled, beware! Take heed, and gather together! Don't get lost in the fog!
Shut up! Tawny Owl roared. Keep quiet!
Absolute silence, or we won't hear,
they heard. A short, strangled cry reached their ears from the fog to the left, from the furthest end of the line, and the sharp, rough grating of skates, making the hair stand on end like iron scoring glass.
But!
Tawny Owl yelled.
Bert! What's happening over there?
They heard an unintelligible cry, and a moment later, Bert Brigden emerged from the fog, fleeing pell-mell. As soon as he was near, he slipped, fell over, and slid across the ice on his stomach.
She got Stigwood,
he panted out, struggling to get up.
She cut him down as she flashed past. So swiftly. I barely saw her. She's a witch.
Skellen swore. Siliphant and Munn, both with swords in hand, whirled around, staring goggle-eyed into the fog. Grating. 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 Quick. Rhythmic. And more clearly. More and more clearly.
Where's it coming from?
Roared Boreas Munn, spinning around, flourishing the blade of his sword two-handed.
Where's it coming from? Quiet!
Screamed Tawny Owl, with an Orion in his raised hand.
I think it's from the right. Yes, from the right. She's coming up on the right. Look out!
The Gemarian walking on the right wing suddenly cursed, turned around, and ran blindly into the fog, sloshing through the melting layer of ice. He didn't get far, not even out of sight. They heard the sharp grating of skates gliding and made out a blurred, flickering shadow and the flash of a sword. The Gemarian howled. They saw him fall, saw a broad spray of blood on the ice. The wounded man thrashed about, curled up, screamed and moaned. Then he fell silent and stopped moving. But while he was still moaning, he drowned out the sound of the skates. They didn't expect the girl to be able to turn back so swiftly. She fell among them, right in their midst. She cleaved Orla Harsheim as she flashed past, low, beneath the knee, folding him up like a penknife. She spun in a pirouette, covering Boreas Munn in a stinging hail of icy shards. Skellen leapt aside, slipped and caught Ryance by a sleeve. They both fell over. The skates grated just beside them, and cold, sharp fragments stung their faces. One of the Gemarians yelled, and his cry broke off in a savage croak. Tawny Owl knew what had happened. He'd heard many people having their throats cut. Ola Hosheim shouted, rolling around on the ice. Grating, grating, grating. Silence.
Mr. Stefan,
Dacre Siliphant gibbered.
Mr. Stefan, you're my only hope. Save me. Don't let me.
She's fucking crippled me,
Ola Hosheim bellowed.
Help me, for fuck's sake. Help me get up.
Bonnot,
Skellin yelled into the fog.
Bonnot, help us. Where are you, you Hossam? Bonnot!
She's got us surrounded,
Boreas Munn gasped, spinning around and straining to hear.
She's skating around us in the fog. She'll strike at will. Death. That wench is death. We'll breathe our last here. It'll be a massacre like it was on Saw and Eve in Dundera. Stick together,
Skellen groaned.
Stick together. She's picking us off one by one. When you see her looming up, don't lose your heads. Trip her up with swords, saddlebags, belts. Use anything to stop her.
He broke off. This time, they didn't even hear the scraping of skates. Dacre Siliphant and Ryans saved their lives by dropping flat onto the ice. Boreas Munn managed to jump aside, slipped, fell over, and upended Bert Brigden. As the girl flashed by, Skellen swung and threw an Orion. It found a target, but not the right one. Ola Hosheim, who had managed to get up, tumbled over in convulsions onto the blood-spattered ice. His staring eyes seemed to cross on the steel star sticking out of the bridge of his nose. The last of the Gemarians threw down his sword and began to sob in short, choking spasms. Skellen sprang at him and struck him hard in the face.
Pull yourself together, he roared. Get a grip on yourself. It's just one girl. Just one girl.
Like in Dundera. And so in Eve, said Boreas Munn softly. We shall never get off this ice, off this lake. Listen out, listen out, and you'll hear death gliding towards you.
Skellen picked up the Gemarian's sword and tried to shove it into the sobbing man's hand, but unsuccessfully. The Gemarian, racked by spasms, turned his dull gaze onto him. Tawny Owl threw down the sword and jumped at Ryans.
Do something, sorcerer,
he roared, tugging at his arm. Terror redoubled his strength, and although Ryans was taller, heavier, and more powerful, he flopped around in Tawny Owl's grasp like a ragdoll.
Do something! Summon that high and mighty Vilgefortz of yours! Work some magic yourself! Work magic! Perform witchcraft! Invoke spirits! Conjure up demons! Do something! Anything, you little turd! Do something before that she-phantom kills us all!
The echo of his cry boomed across the forested hillsides. Before it died away, the skates grated again. The sobbing Gemarian fell to his knees and covered his face in his hands. Bert Brigden howled, flung his sword away, and bolted. He slipped, fell over, and scampered for a few paces on all fours like a dog.
Ryans!
The sorcerer swore and raised a hand. As he chanted the spell, his hand was trembling, his voice too. But he was successful, though not, admittedly, completely successful. The thread-like, fiery lightning bolt spurting from his fingers carved up the ice, fracturing the surface. But not crossways, as it should have, to bar the way of the approaching girl. It broke lengthways. The crust of ice cleaved open with a loud cracking sound. Black water gushed and rumbled, and the rapidly widening rift shot towards Dacre Siliphant, who was looking on in stupefaction.
Jump aside! Skellen yelled. Run!
It was too late. The crack sped between Siliphant's legs and split open, the ice shattering like glass and breaking into huge slabs. Dacre lost his balance, and the water stifled his howl. Boreas Munn fell into the breach. The kneeling Gemarian vanished under the water, and Ola Hosheim's body disappeared. Ryans plopped after them into the black depths, followed by Skellen, who managed to catch hold of the edge at the last moment. Meanwhile, the girl pushed off powerfully and flew over the breach, landing so hard the melting ice splashed and darted after the fleeing Brigden. A moment later, a hair-raising scream reached the ears of Tawny Owl, who was hanging onto the edge of the ice floe. She'd caught up with him.
Sir,
moaned Boreas Munn, who by some miracle had managed to crawl out onto the ice.
Give me your hand, my Lord Coroner.
After being hauled out, Skellen turned blue and began to shiver violently. The edge of the ice was breaking under Siliphant, who was struggling to drag himself out. Dacre vanished beneath the water again, but but he surfaced at once, choking and spitting, and dragged himself onto the ice with superhuman effort. He crawled out and collapsed, exhausted to the limits. A puddle spread out beside him. Boreas moaned and closed his eyes. Skellen was trembling.
Save me! Man! Help!
Ryons hung onto the edge of the ice, submerged up to his armpits. His wet hair was plastered smoothly to his skull. His teeth were chattering like castanets, sounding like a ghoulish overture to some infernal dance macabre. The skates grated. Boreas didn't move. He waited. Skellen was trembling. She approached, slowly. Blood trickled from her sword, marking the ice with a trail of drops. Boreas swallowed. Although he was soaked to the skin with icy water, he suddenly felt unbearably hot. But the girl wasn't looking at him. She was looking at Ryons, who was vainly struggling to get out onto the ice.
Help me!
Ryons overcame the chattering of his teeth.
Save me!
The girl braked, whirling on the skates with the grace of a dancer. She stood with legs slightly apart, holding her sword in both hands, low across her thighs.
Help me!
Ryons howled, digging his numbing fingers into the ice.
Save me, and I'll tell you where Yennefer is. I swear.
The girl slowly pulled the scar from her face and smiled. Boreas Munn saw the hideous scar and fought to stifle a shout.
Ryons, said Ciri, still smiling. You were going to teach me pain, weren't you? Do you remember? With those hands. With those fingers. Those ones? Those? The ones you're holding the ice with?
Ryons answered, but Boreas didn't understand what he said, for the sorcerer's teeth were chattering and rattling so much they made articulated speech impossible. Ciri spun around on her skates and lifted the sword. Boreas clenched his teeth, convinced she would slash Ryons. But the girl was picking up momentum to set off. To the tracker's astonishment, she skated away quickly, gathering speed with powerful thrusts. She vanished into the fog. And a moment later, the rhythmic scraping of the skates also died away.
Man, pull me out!
Ryan sparked out, chin on the edge of the ice floe. He flung both hands on the ice, trying to hang on with his fingernails, which had largely been torn away. He spread his fingers, trying to cling to the blood-stained ice with his hands and wrists. Boreas Munn looked at him and was certain, terrifyingly certain. They heard the grinding of the skates at the last moment. The girl approached at extraordinary speed, literally a blur. She skated up at the very edge of the floe, speeding along right beside the brink. Ryons screamed and choked on the viscous, leaden water and vanished. There was blood on the ice, on the perfectly even tracks left by the skates. And fingers. 8 fingers. Boreas Munn vomited on the ice. Bonnart galloped along the edge of the lake, hurtling along, heedless that any moment the horse might break its legs on the snow-covered clefts. Frosted over spruce branches lashed his face and whipped his arms, and icy powder poured down his collar. He couldn't see the lake. The entire valley was filled with fog, like a bubbling witch's cauldron. But Bonnart knew the girl was there. He sensed it. Deep under the ice, a school of striped perch curiously followed the silver, fascinatingly glimmering casket, which had slipped out of the pocket of a corpse floating in the water. Before the casket had sunk to the bottom, raising a cloud of silt, the boldest of the perch even tried to nudge it with their snouts, but they suddenly took flight in terror. The casket was emitting strange, alarming vibrations.
Ryons, can you hear me? What's been going on? Why haven't you responded for 2 days? Give me a report. What about the maid? You can't let her enter the tower. Do you hear? You can't let her enter the Tower of the Swallow. Ryons, answer, damn it. Ryons.
Ryons, naturally, could not answer. The embankment came to an end. The shore flattened out.
It's the end of the lake, thought Bonnard. I've done it. I've trapped the maid. Where is she? And where's that sodding tower?
The curtain of fog suddenly ruptured and lifted. And then he saw her. She was right in front of him, sitting on her black mare.
She's a witch, he thought. She communicates with that beast. She sent it to the end of the lake and ordered it to wait for her. But that won't help her. I have to kill her. The devil take Vilgefortz. I have to kill her. First, I'll make her beg for her life, and then I'll kill her.
He yelled, pricked his horse with his spurs, and launched into a breakneck gallop, and suddenly realized he had lost, that she'd deceived him. Not more than a furlong separated him from her, but over thin ice. She was on the other side of the lake. What's more, the crescent of open water now curved around the opposite way. The girl, riding along the bowstring, was much closer to the end of the lake than he was. Bonnard swore, tugged on the reins, and steered his horse onto the ice.
Ride, Kelpie!
Frozen earth shot from under the black mare's hooves. Ciri clung to the horse's neck. The sight of Bonnard pursuing her filled her with dread. She was afraid of him. An invisible fist tightened on her stomach at the thought of facing him in combat. No, she couldn't fight him, not yet. The tower. Only the tower could save her, and the portal. As on Thanheth, when the sorcerer Vilgefortz was upon her, was already reaching for her. The only hope was the Tower of the Swallow. The fog lifted. Ciri reined in her horse, suddenly feeling a dreadful heat. Unable to believe what she saw, what was in front of her. Barnard saw it too, and yelled triumphantly. There was no tower at the end of the lake. There weren't even the ruins of a tower. There was nothing. Just a barely visible, barely outlined hillock. Just a mound of boulders covered in frozen, leafless stalks.
That's your tower, he roared. That's your magical tower. That's your salvation. A heap of stones.
The girl seemed not to hear or see. She urged the mare nearer the hillock onto the stony mound. She raised both hands towards the sky as though cursing the heavens for what had befallen her.
I told you that you were mine, roared Bonnard,
spurring on his bay,
that I'll do what I want with you, that no one will stop me from doing it, not people, not gods, not devils, nor demons, or enchanted towers. You're mine, Witcher girl.
The bay's shoes jangled on the icy surface of the lake. The fog suddenly swirled, boiled under the impact of a strong wind appearing as if from nowhere. The bay whinnied and danced, baring its teeth on the bit. Bonnard leaned back in the saddle and tugged on the reins with all his might because the horse was frantic, tossing its head, stamping and slipping on the ice. In front of him, between him and the shore where Ciri was standing, a snowy white unicorn was dancing on the ice, rearing up as if on a heraldic shield.
Don't try tricks like that on me, roared the bounty hunter,
fighting to get control of his horse.
You won't frighten me with sorcery. I'll catch you, Ciri. I'll kill you this time, witcher girl. You're mine.
The fog swirled again and seethed, forming bizarre shapes. The shapes became clearer and clearer. They were horsemen, nightmarish silhouettes of eerie horsemen. Bonnard stared, goggle-eyed. Skeleton riders rode skeleton horses dressed in rust-riddled armor and chainmail, ragged cloaks, dented and corroded helmets decorated with buffalo horns and the remains of ostrich and peacock plumes. The spectre's eyes shined with a bluish light from under their visors. Ragged pennants swished. An armed man with a crown on his helmet and a necklace bumping against the rusty cuirass on his chest galloped at the head of the demonic cavalcade.
Be gone, rumbled a voice in Bonnard's head. Be gone, mortal. She is not yours. She is ours. Be gone.
There was no denying Bonnard had one thing. Courage. He did not take fright at the apparitions. He overcame his terror and did not give in to panic. But his horse turned out to be less resolute. The bay reared, danced ballet-like on its hind legs, whinnied frantically, kicked and pranced. The ice broke with a horrifying crunching sound under the impact of its hooves. The sheets of ice stood up vertically and water gushed out. The horse squealed and struck the edge with its forehooves, fracturing it. Bonnart yanked his feet from the stirrups and jumped. Too late. The water closed over his head. There was a drumming and a ringing, as though in a belfry. His lungs were full to bursting. He was lucky. His feet, kicking out in the water, struck something, probably his horse as it sank to the bottom. He pushed off, bursting from the water, spitting and gasping. He seized hold of the edge of the ice hole. Without yielding to panic, he drew a knife, drove it into the ice, and hauled himself out. He lay, panting heavily, the water trickling from him and splashing down. The lake, the ice, the snow-bound hillsides, the black and frost-encrusted spruce forest, all of a sudden everything was flooded with an unnatural, pallid light. Bonnart struggled to his knees with immense effort. Above the horizon, the deep blue was lit by a crown of brightness, a luminous dome from which fiery pillars and spirals suddenly rose and scintillating columns and vortices of light burst forth. Shimmering, flickering, rapidly changing shapes, ribbons and curtains hung on the horizon. Bonnart croaked. It was as though he had an iron garrote around his throat. A tower had risen up where a moment before had been only a barren hillock and a pile of stones. Majestic, soaring and slender, black, glassy and gleaming, as though carved from a single piece of basalt. Fire flickered in the few windows, and the aurora borealis glowed in the serrated battlements. He saw the girl looking towards him from the saddle. He saw her bright eyes and the cheek slashed by the line of an ugly scar. He saw the girl spur her black mare and unhurriedly ride into the black gloom under the arched stone entrance and disappear. The aurora borealis exploded in dazzling swirls of fire. When Bonnart regained his sight, the tower was gone. There was the snow-topped hillock, the pile of stones, the withered black stalks. Kneeling on the ice in the puddle of water trickling from him, the bounty hunter screamed savagely, horribly. On his knees, arms raised towards the sky, he screamed, howled, swore and railed against people, gods and demons. The echo of his cries rolled over the spruce forested hillsides, drifted over the frozen surface of Tarn Mirror Lake. At first, the inside of the tower reminded her of Caer Morhen, the same long black corridor behind a colonnade, the same unending abyss in the perspective of columns or statues. It was beyond comprehension how that abyss could fit into the slender obelisk of the tower. But she knew, of course, that there was no point analysing it, not in the case of a tower that had risen up from nothingness, appearing where it had not been before. There could be anything in such a tower, and one ought not to be surprised by anything. She looked back. She didn't believe Bonnart had dared or managed to enter after her. But she wanted to make certain. The colonnade she had ridden into blazed with an unnatural brilliance. Kelpie's hooves rang on the floor, something crunched under them. Bones. Skulls, shin bones, rib cages, thigh bones, hip bones. She was riding through a gigantic ossuarium. Caer Morhen, she thought, recalling. The dead should be buried in the ground. How long ago that was. I still believed in something like that then, in the majesty of death, in respect for the dead. But death is simply death, and a dead person is just a cold corpse. It's not important where it's lying, where its bones decay. She rode into the gloom under the colonnade, among the columns and statues. The darkness undulated like smoke. Her ears were filled with intrusive whispers, sighs and soft incantations. Suddenly, brightness flamed before her as a gigantic door opened. One door opened after another. Doors. An infinite number of heavy doors opened before her without a murmur. Kelpie went on, horseshoes resounding on the floor. The geometry of the walls, arcades and columns surrounding her was suddenly disrupted, so confusingly that Ciri felt dizzy. She felt as though she were inside an impossible, multifaceted solid, some gigantic polyhedron. The doors kept opening. But now they weren't delineating a single direction. They were pointing to infinite directions and possibilities. And Ciri began to see. A black-haired woman leading an ashen-haired girl by the hand. The girl is afraid, afraid of the dark. Fears the whispers growing in the gloom, is terrified by the ringing of horseshoes. The black-haired woman with a star sparkling with diamonds around her neck is also afraid, but does not let it show. She leads the girl on, towards her destiny. Kelpie walks on, more doors. Yola the Second and Yurneid, in sheepskin coats, with their bundles, marching along a frozen, snowy road. The sky is deep blue. More doors. Yola the First, kneeling before an altar. Beside her is Mother Nenica. They are both looking at something, their faces contorted in a grimace of dread. What do they see? The past or the future? Truth or untruth? Above Nenica and Yola, hands. The hands of a woman with golden eyes held out in a gesture of blessing. In the woman's necklace, a diamond shining like the morning star. On the woman's shoulder, a cat. Over her head, a falcon. More doors. Triss Merigold holds back her glorious chestnut hair, buffeted and tugged by gusts of wind. There is no escape from the wind. Nothing can shelter from the wind. Not here. Not on the brow of the hill. A long, unending row of shadows encroaches on the hill. Forms. They are walking slowly. Some turn their faces towards her. Familiar faces. Vesemir. Eskel. Lambert. Cohen. Jarpen Zigrin. And Pauli Dahlberg. Fabio Sachs. Yara. Tisaya de Vries. Missel. Geralt. Mordors. Yennefer in chains, fastened to a dungeon wall dripping with water. Her hands are a single mass of clotted blood. Her black hair is tousled and dishevelled. Her mouth is cut and swollen, but her will to fight and resistance are undampened in her violet eyes.
Mummy, hold on. Don't give up. I'm coming to help you.
More doors. Ciri turns her head away in distress and embarrassment. Geralt, and a green-eyed woman with black, close-cropped hair. Both naked, engrossed by and consumed with each other, with giving each other sensual pleasure. Ciri fights to overcome the adrenaline tightening her throat and spurs Kelpie on. Hooves clatter, whispers pulsate in the darkness. More doors.
Welcome, Ciri.
Visagota?
I knew you would succeed. Oh, courageous maiden, my brave swallow, did you emerge unharmed?
I defeated them, on the ice. I had a surprise for them. Your daughter skates.
I meant psychological harm.
I held back from vengeance. I didn't kill them all. I didn't kill Tawny Owl. Even though he hurt and disfigured me, I controlled myself.
I knew you'd prevail, Ziriel, and that you'd enter the tower. Why, I've read about it. Because it has already been described. It has all been written about. Do you know what learning gives you? The ability to make use of sources.
How is it possible that we're talking? Oh, Visigota, are you...
Yes, Ciri. I'm dead.
Oh, never mind.
What I have learned is more important. What I have worked out. Now I know what became of the lost days. What happened in Korath Desert. How you vanished from the sight of your pursuers.
And how I entered here. Entered this tower, right?
The elder blood that flows in your veins gives you power over time and over space, over the dimensions and the spheres. You are now master of the worlds, Ciri. You have a mighty power. Do not let criminals or rogues take it from you and use it to their own ends. I won't. Farewell, Ciri. Farewell, Swallow.
Farewell, old Raven.
More doors. Brightness, dazzling brightness, and the heady scent of flowers. A mist lay on the lake, a haze as light as down, which the wind quickly blew away. The surface of the water was as smooth as a mirror. Flowers shone white on green carpets of flat lily pads. The banks drowned in leaves and flowers. It was warm. It was spring. Ciri was not surprised. How could she be? After all, now everything was possible. November, ice, snow, frozen ground, the mound of stones on the hillock bristling with dried stalks. That was there. But here is here. Here, a soaring basalt tower, crowned with serrated battlements, reflected in the green water of the lake, dotted with the white of water lilies. Here, it's May. For wild roses and bird cherry bloom in May, don't they? Nearby, somebody was playing on a whistle or a pan flute. They were playing a jolly, lively tune. On the lakeside, two snow-white horses were drinking, four hooves in the water. Kelpie snorted and banged a hoof against a rock. Then the horses lifted their heads and nostrils, dripping water, and Ciri sighed. Because they weren't horses, but unicorns. Ciri was not surprised. She was sighing in awe, not in astonishment. She could hear the tune more and more clearly. It was coming from behind the shrubs of bird cherry festooned with white blossom. Kelpie moved towards the sound by herself, without any urging. Ciri swallowed. The two unicorns, as still as statues reflected in the surface of the water, as smooth as a mirror, looked at her. A fair-haired elf, with a triangular face and huge almond-shaped eyes, was sitting on a round stone beyond the bird cherry shrub. He played on, nimbly running his lips over the pipes. Although he could see Ciri and Kelpie, although he was looking at them, he didn't stop playing. The small flowers gave off a scent. Ciri had never encountered bird cherry with such an intense fragrance.
No wonder, she thought quite soberly. Bird cherry blossom simply smells different in the world I've lived in until this moment. Because everything is different in that world.
The elf finished his tune with a long, drawn-out, high-pitched trill, took the instrument from his mouth and stood up.
"What took you so long?" he asked with a smile. "What kept you?"
This has been a Hachette audio production of The Tower of Swallows, written by Andrei Sapkowski, translated by David French, read by Peter Kenny, executive producer Pandora White, directed by Katie Story, edited by Wolfgang Dienst. The Tower of Swallows is also available in print and digital formats from Orbit, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 1997 by Andrei Sapkowski. English translation copyright 2016 by David French. Audio production copyright 2016 by the Orion Publishing Group. All rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright. The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this audiobook, without permission, is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales is entirely coincidental.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.